the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. The first seductive voice you heard was that of Sarita singing Sunny, and she was singing it accompanied by Ella Fitzgerald's favorite guitarist, Joe Pass. And of course, the next voice you heard was the greatest pop singer of the last 100 years, Frank Sinatra, introducing yours truly when I appeared on the Tonight Show with him. And this is the voice of John Barber, living in John Barber's world, right here in the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. It is September 7th, Labor Day, a day that decades ago meant something to America, when America had unions and Americans had jobs. Today, it's about as useless as Jenner's jockey shorts. I mean, except for it being a day off, it now actually gets less attention and press than do National Pickle Day, which is November 14th, and National Donut Day, which gets even more attention. And that's the first Friday in June for all of you Krispy Kremers. Anyway, to me, the only way we can maintain that day with that title, since no new jobs are coming up, regardless of what Trump, our now independent Republican, promises, is to dedicate Labor Day just to expectant mothers. Later in today's show, we're going to be talking to the brightest economic and political analyst, journalist I know. His name is Joe Sottile. He's a semi-regular here, and you're going to hear why. I want to talk about some of the startling revelations about politics and labor in his Today's News Vandal, the best, most objective daily newsletter around. But right now, as you know, we are 4 days short of September 11th. The day of the most horrific, cruel, politically motivated crime in American history, probably more so than even the murder of President John F. Kennedy. Each led to fake wars, and each led to fake investigations. Hundreds upon hundreds of prominent politicians, scientists, engineers, architects, pilots, and stewardesses have been speaking out for years about a new investigation. I mean, if you Google, quote, pilots and aviation professionals question 911, unquote, you can see who some are. Today, we have two of the most articulate and passionate. A former Air Force combat pilot with over 100 missions and a decades-long pilot for Pan Am and United, who actually flew the two planes that were supposed to have hit the towers. He is now running for political office in Arizona. His name is Captain Russ Wittenberg. And with Russ, a 30-year stewardess, also trained as an emergency medical technician, who recounted her story in a riveting best-selling book called Methodical Illusion, and now the more controversial and powerful sequel just out, Methodical Deception. Rebecca Roth and Captain Russ Wittenberg, thank you both for being here very, very much. Russ, since you are the captain of this flight into fact, where were you the day it happened? What was your impression at the end of the day's newscast? And how long was it before you began to question it?
Well, I was home. I was home sleeping, and a good friend of mine, who was a radio talk show host here in Phoenix, where I live, called me on the phone. It was about 6-something in the morning, and he called me up, and he says, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you think I'm doing? I'm sleeping." He said, "Well, turn on the TV." He says, you're going to want to watch this, because he was, and that was just before second plane hit the South Tower. And I immediately, when I saw it, and after I watched the buildings come down in this ridiculous manner, I knew right away something was wrong. And from that moment on, I was dedicated to try to find out what was really going on. Because
Were you actually questioning why the towers came down, or were you questioning the fact that since you had been such a pilot and flown those particular planes, were you questioning how it would be possible for the planes to be making those maneuvers?
No, I was at first, I didn't know the plane that what planes hit the were involved. It was only well afterward that I found out it was the two airplanes, two United aircraft involved were airplanes that I had previously flown pilot and command on. But it was well before that, I thought something was very, very fishy about the whole thing, because the buildings and the way they collapsed, they didn't collapse, they were vaporized, they were blown up.
Okay, and, then that was your impression immediately. Did you speak about this just to your family or to your friends, or did you call other pilots and ask about what happened?
Well, at first everybody was stunned, and like I was stunned that something like this would be happening. But you see, having been in politics for 50-some years, it's kind of giving away my age. I understand what false flag operations are. And I thought immediately this would look like a perfect false flag operation, which I believe it is to this second. And so, yes, I did talk to people about it, and ended up getting involved with a friend of mine who I ended up being a silent co-author with, who wrote a book about it was the original book, Painful Questions 9/11, with Eric Hushman.
Yes, an excellent book. You probably recall also the day it happened, there were two or three reporters standing in front of the Pentagon who said on CNN or on the networks they were broadcasting that no plane hit the Pentagon.
Exactly. Because no plane did hit the Pentagon, and that I think if given enough time, I can explain that.
Then what I don't understand then, with it so obvious that there were no Rolls-Royce tons of engines lying around, and it was impossible for that hole to be like that, there's you and hundreds of other professionals like yourself who are all over that site, that you know, professional airline folk questioning this, and you're in great, impressive company. Why is it that any investigation that's truthful is being roadblocked? It's not even being roadblocked. It's not even started. Why?
Well, the 9/11 Commission was so-called 9/11 Commission was not to find the truth. It was to cover up the truth. It was a whitewash, like the John F. Kennedy Commission was just a whitewash. It never uncovered the truth. Lee Harvey Oswald no more shot John F. Kennedy than you and I did.
Well,
so all of these false flag operations are not new. It's something which has been going on for a long time.
What political office are you running for in Arizona?
I haven't announced yet, so I don't want to mention it. But I'm talking very seriously, getting things put together, and but it's going to be very interesting.
Okay, so the question would be this. Since you're so politically motivated to do something about this false flag operation, do you think that is going to help or hinder you with voters?
Well, see, the first thing they're going to do is go to Google and just put my name in there. You're going to see it. You're going to come up with all of these things I've been involved with 9/11. And so they're going to try to use that as a lemon to, you know, to smear me and paint me up as some kind of a kook. But I'm going to turn lemons into lemonade by using that and say, hey, look at, you know, this 9/11 was the single most important event of the 21st century so far. And I'm going to paint my opponent as being a do-nothing office holder, and that we should be conducting a new full-scale operation of this most important event of the 21st century, because it is what is being used, it is the reason, is the cause celeb that this country has taken the path that it has taken since 9/11 with all these draconian, unconstitutional police state laws which have been passed, turning us into a certified police state headed toward a one-world government.
Russ, America's leading intellectual, or he's regarded as America's leading intellectual, especially on American foreign policy, is Noam Chomsky. And why is it that Noam Chomsky, this leading intellectual who talks all the time about foreign policy, America's dreadful foreign policy, especially about the Middle East, absolutely refuses to talk about 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination? I have seen him confronted by students when he speaks at colleges, and they get up and ask him that question, and he poo-poos them and denigrates them and said, it's of no interest. Why is that? And even that Japanese-American scientist who's on the networks all the time, gray-haired, nice-looking gentleman, I forget his last name, but he's questioned by students, and he poo-poos them. I mean, any idiot can see what you saw.
Well, he has a political agenda, and I think the agenda stems from his, you might say, religion.
Well, that brings me to Rebecca Stewardess. I have her book. Rebecca, I must say, I love it, and I especially love the dedication to me. It's autographed, and it says, fasten your seatbelts, and folks, you must get it, and fasten your seatbelts. It's written fictitiously, but the real images come up when you read it. Okay, the first question that I posed to Russ, I posed to you, Rebecca. Where were you when it happened? What were your first impressions, and when did you begin to question it?
I had just come home from Europe about 10 hours before, and just like Russ, I'm sure every airline employee's phone rang, and mine did, and someone on the other line said, turn on the television right now, in a voice that made me turn my television on right now. And I did it just in time to see that plane hit into the South Tower. My first reaction was, I thought it was an updated a replay of the War of the Worlds, a fake a terrorist attack, fake, completely faked photography, because as a flight attendant, and you know, I know I'm sure pilots do the same thing, we have a recurrent training every year and we study crashes. And I had never seen an aluminum aircraft float into a building and disappear the way I did that morning, like a hot knife through butter. And I thought, that's why I thought it was trick photography. And so at first I thought the person calling me was in some sort of remote control of my television set and just faking me out. And then when I heard that cell phone calls were being made from the crew members and from the passengers, that was a red flag for me. And as I looked into and listened for the next few days, now I was on the ground for about 2 weeks after that, so I was glued to my television set. And I saw and heard and read everything possible out there that the flight attendants and the pilots did not follow FAA protocol. And I know Russ will tell you this, they hadn't changed really since the early 1970s. And so we had code words and step-by-step protocol to follow. Pilots had something that they would do. And the thing that really woke me up is I let it go. I retired from flying in 2004. I found it very suspicious that during our recurrent training in those 3 years that I did fly, that we were never told anything by the FAA. And if we asked a question, we got the stare down from the person teaching our class to don't ever bring that up again. And then
exactly.
I didn't pay any attention until I started to write a novel in 2008, 2009, because I had a really exciting life. And everyone said, yeah, you should write a book. And so what I wanted to bring in a Middle Eastern character into my novel, and I Google searched 19 Arab hijackers, 9/11, and I discovered a BBC article from September 23rd, 2001. I had never seen before, stating that the Saudi government was threatening to sue the FBI and the United States for stealing the identity of several of their citizens.
That
woke me up. And my novel ended up turning into thousands of hours of research into 9/11 because I knew there was no plane crash at Shanksville because I'd studied plane crashes. And I saw Jamie McIntyre on CNN and I saw the television show no plane, no 757 was at the Pentagon. So I didn't know what it was that hit the North Tower because there was no filming of that at all until much later from the Naudette brothers who were doing a documentary for the New York firefighters. And now I've got a picture of that slowed down, and whatever it is that's flying into the North Tower, I guarantee you it's not a 767, because when you slow it down and take a still image, it's spiraling. And
there were many witnesses on the ground immediately who said no plane hit the building. One man said there were no windows. Somebody else said it was all silver and it looked like a rocket.
That's true. There were firefighters on a fireboat that called into dispatch, and this is on YouTube, you can find it, that said that the plane was a military-style bomber-type airplane that flew into the South Tower. And it's on recording from their New York Fire Department dispatch. So what happened to me was I found everything that I wanted to find, which was what happened to the planes, the passengers, and the crew members that day, because I knew that there was no plane crash at the Pentagon in Shanksville. I didn't know what hit the North Tower, and I wasn't sure about that plane because it was, to me, trick photography that went into the South Tower.
The most astonishing thing to me, I was at NBC News in Los Angeles for years, a critic at large with Tom Snyder, who eventually went on to do the Today Show, and Tom Brokaw, who went from there to the network. And the thing that astonished me is that every network was carrying the same visuals. Now, how was that possible? I would turn to CBS and I wanted to see a different angle. It would be the same angle as CNN, the same angle as Fox, the same angle as ABC. How is that possible and why did that happen?
Well, they seem to have one photographer from a helicopter that they all were using. And I found some really intriguing connections for methodical deception. I discovered that something that a lot of people didn't understand, and I was flying long enough to remember when it was brought to us by Boeing from a company called SBC Corporation. It's actually the way we control our drones around the world. It's called the Flight Termination System, and it's a plug-in device into the onboard computer on the aircraft. United and American both bought into it, and Boeing sold it. In the event of a hijacking and a hijacker would take control of the cockpit, we can land the aircraft remotely. That's how they sold it. The problem that the pilots in my company were having with it is once the flight termination took over, it used the same frequency as the transponder, which is what showed the air traffic controllers the location, altitude, the type of aircraft, and the company information. And basically, once the flight termination system took over, the pilots lost all communication with other aircraft, with air traffic control, and the flight attendants in the back. So when I was looking at Flight 11, and I saw that two flight attendants were calling in, not following protocol, even one of them said, "I don't know, but we might be being hijacked." And then they both referred to the hijackers, one single person, and one flight attendant even said he was sitting at 9B. Well, I looked into who was at 9B, and it was a highly trained assassin from the Israeli Defense Forces called Sayeret Matkal. His friend said he could kill any human being with a pen and a credit card, and yet we're led to believe that he was the only one killed prior to the airplane crashing. But that's not the case at all. I found out that he was actually a handler on board. There were no 19 Arabs on those planes.
We have all discovered that. Now, with all of this information out there, why has nothing happened on a national level to really look into this? I mean, it's all over the internet. These facts are everywhere. What is roadblocking this? What is stopping it?
It's called AIPAC, the Israeli lobby in the United States, because every single road I went down, keep in mind, when I discovered these hijackers were still alive, I thought it was 19 Arabs. That's what I was Google searching to find a first name off one and a last name off the other. I had no idea what I was going to find, that I was going to find the Israeli Mossad, and I found them very, very deeply involved in this.
Well, it seems the only widely broadcast report about any kind of Israelis, well, that woman who from her apartment saw these dancing Israelis on a van videotaping the disaster, and they were arrested and not charged, and they were allowed to leave the United States, and I think they call themselves art students. And I saw on your page for Methodical Deception one of the most startling pictures I've ever seen. I mean, we're not trying to speculate on who did this, but it is obvious that these paths weren't followed. This great picture on your Methodical Deception page of so-called art students in the towers. Explain who they are. And I noticed from the construction cards they were issued, they were in there for almost a year. Tell me about that. And I would urge anyone listening to go to methodicaldeception.com and see these unbelievable photographs. How did you get them, and describe what they are?
I actually discovered everything I used to write the Methodical Deception was United States documents. I was fortunate after Methodical Illusion came out to be contacted by someone who'd gotten a great deal of Freedom of Information Act data. So I have nearly a terabyte full of NORAD, FAA radar, and other voice files and lots and lots and lots of data. I have a document from the FAA headquarters that claims, now keep in mind, only two flight attendants were talking to someone on the ground off Flight 11. And so there's no way, and neither one of them mentioned this, so there's no way they knew this unless the FAA made it up. But at 8:44, they claim on an FAA document out of FAA headquarters that a passenger was shot, meaning they had a gun on board. But it's all make-believe. I don't know if that was part of a drill or what, but as soon as they did that, they sort of buried that document. But it actually showed up in this Freedom of Information Act file I have. It's a huge file.
So, when the dancing Israelis were sent back to Israel, there seemed to be, I don't know if they're doctored or not, but there seemed to be YouTubes out there of them being interviewed on an Israeli television show. Could you tell me if that's true? And could you tell me what they said?
Yes, that is true. And they said they were sent to the United States to document the event, which means someone in Israel sent them to the United States to document the events, which mean they knew beforehand that the event was going to happen. I have someone who contacted my publisher, whose wife was in the Pentagon the morning of 9/11, and 1 to 2 hours prior to anything hitting in New York, her phone at her office rang. A voice, she still doesn't know who, said, "Get the hell out of the Pentagon and get out of there now." She grabbed her purse and her belongings and left the building, and then things started happening in New York, and of course later on the Pentagon was supposedly struck by something.
Russ, would you like to elaborate or confirm a lot of what Rebecca is telling us?
Well, that's a load. That's a lot to elaborate. I fundamentally, I agree with her just about everything. There's so much evidence. You know, the government story on 9/11 has more holes in it than a screen door. Mm-hmm. And it's only if you just I just want to look at the pictures and accept everything the government tells you, that's your average American today. Unfortunately,
well,
there's some
documents. As a pilot, what she's saying is that they could take over the flight, but in a case like that, doesn't the Air Force scramble jets? Have you ever had an occasion, either one of you, when something looked like it might be going amiss, and all of a sudden you looked out the window and there was the United States Air Force accompanying you?
No, that's only if you get off course by a couple, more than a few miles.
Then
they'll Do you remember the golf PGA golfer Payne Stewart?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Died in that horrific crash.
About 15 years ago, Payne Stewart chartered a Lear 35 from, I think, Orlando to Dallas-Fort Worth. And as the plane was cleared to flight level 390, and as they were going up on autopilot and auto throttles, evidently the airplane was it lost pressure somehow, and the pilots didn't handle it correctly for some reason. No one will ever know the real reason why. And the airplane lost radio contact with Jacksonville Center at about 20,000 feet as it was climbing up to 390. And within 20 minutes, there were two F-16s flying wing on that Lear 35. Now, are you telling me that we have four airplanes that take off and then they're all over the sky? They're violating their route of flight. They're not on their intended flight track, and the airplanes, there's no jet fighters sent up to investigate why they are. There's nobody answering, and there was a stand down by air traffic by the Air Defense Command at that time, and the fighters were held down, and when they finally did get off the ground, they were sent off in the wrong direction, all over the ocean.
Let me ask.
It's totally ridiculous that, for example, in Phoenix here where I live, if four 18-wheelers got off around the what they call the loop, and they were going in the wrong direction at well over 100 miles an hour, how long do you think it would take the sheriff and the Phoenix PD to understand there's something going wrong?
Okay, With air traffic control,
it would be a whole lot quicker because they see instantaneously that if you deviate left or right of centerline more than a mile or two, they're going to call you and say, hey, what do you think you're doing? Where are you going?
Rebecca, in your research and bringing up this information about the Mossad, I think there were probably 36 Israelis arrested in New York City that day. All of them were released. All of them went back to Israel. If you're saying that Mossad is obviously involved with this, would they have had some assistance? Because there seem to be a lot of rumors that Cheney was the one who was holding down the Air Force from going to intercept those planes.
Well, you know, I actually have all the radar data, and Russ, I'd love to connect with you somehow if we can do that after we get done talking, either through Skype or telephone and get connected. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time. I have all the radar data. I actually have all the information from Payne Stewart's flight as well. I don't know why that's in this Freedom of Information Act data, if they just wanted to show us how fast they can respond and didn't. On 9/11, I honestly don't know why it's all in there, but it is. So I can tell you exactly how long it took. I've just never looked into it because I was busy studying 9/11.
The last
contact with the pilots from Flight 11, the official story claims they lost radar contact with them at 8:20. That is a complete and total lie. They lost transponder and lost contact with them between 8:09 and 8:13. Now, the Boston Air Traffic Control didn't contact NORAD for almost 20 minutes. They didn't even make a motion to try to get a hold of them. But here's the problem. On 9/11, we had over a dozen military war games going on. Most of those included hijacked aircraft into buildings. So when Boston Air Traffic Control did call into NEAD's northeast sector of NORAD, they said, is this live or is this the drill? That whole thing caused a problem. Another thing that happened, because the war games were going on, a lot of those first, what we used to call Strategic Air Command alert aircraft that would be scrambled were somewhere else. Some of them were in Arizona. Some of them had been sent to Alaska. There was a major shortage of aircraft on the ground. And here's one of the things I did for a methodical deception. I followed all of those people in the military, the FAA, NORAD, every one of them, I followed them all after they left their job, and they all should have lost their job, and now I know the corporations they're with, and it's all in the methodical delusion, I mean, deception.
Okay, it is a delusion. If planes did not hit the buildings, and that's entirely possible, tell me about the woman who said she saw one of the planes fly over her north of New York.
One of the things that happened after Methodical Illusion came out and I started doing radio interviews is a woman bought the book. She read the book and she contacted me. She was an eyewitness for United 175 over flying northbound over Otis, Massachusetts. And her story, her entire story, is in my book. It is also now written in a notarized affidavit. And she'll go to court to put her life on the line for this. I did change her name in the book, but it is exactly her statement, word for word. I have it on tape. Exactly what time. Now, see, United 175 was taken over by the flight termination system just south of Westover Air Force Base, and it circled around to the west and landed to the southwest on the long 11,595-foot runway. And that's exactly the time that I knew it was. I have their flight plan and part of this data. So I knew exactly where they were. I knew exactly when they lost contact with that aircraft. And that's why it takes a little bit longer for the phone calls to come out of Flight 175 than it did from Flight 11. And I used to fly out of Boston, so this was not uncommon to me. But knowing that the aircraft were flying heavy, full of fuel, I knew they needed at least a 10,000-foot runway to land those birds on. And I found a reserve Air Force base, and a reservist contacted me after an interview, told me the name of the base. She had been based there. She had been activated. Her unit is a C-5 transport unit, and they'd been activated the minute the second plane hit. They got to the base. The base had been evacuated of all personnel, and they were locked out and put up in hotels for 2 to 3 days. She didn't know why until she heard my interview.
Oh, my goodness. So I have one last question for you, and I wish I had scheduled an hour or two with the both of you because you are so intensely interesting. And the question is this. Because of the fact that I got the only interview with Jim Garrison following the Clay Shaw trial and did a documentary called The Garrison Tapes, I turned down all invitations to go speak at these seminars that are held every November 22nd in every American city. And I finally consented to do one in Dallas last year, and I told the standing room audience that they were a total waste of time. They were doing a moment of silence for John F. Kennedy, and I said, we've had silence for 50 years. What we need is a moment of outrage. We need November 22nd to become America's Bastille Day instead of meeting in New York or in Chicago or New Orleans or Dallas. You should all meet in front of the Justice Department on November 22nd because a case is still open and demand it. Would it be possible, because you folks have more important people involved with the truce that you know, would it be possible on September 11th of next year to gather 10,000 people in Washington and demand that they discard AIPAC and investigate this properly? Is that possible, and who could lead it?
Well, we need a captain, Russ. Are you ready for it?
Well, I don't know if it's possible because the American people have been dumbed down so much that, with putting fluoride in the water and all the other schemes what a lot of people call the globalists, which are really nothing more than Zionists that are hell bent on taking the country over and making a one world government. And so whether or not the American people, are smart enough to understand the significance of what has been going on since 9/11.
It is indeed true.
I don't know.
John Kennedy was trying to get AIPAC registered as a foreign lobby and was taking them to court when he was shot and killed, and no president ever dared to question AIPAC again. So then I would let you close, Rebecca, by saying, do you think it's possible that there's somebody who could lead 10,000 people to Washington to get this opened next September 11th.
I know one thing. Once I was on Coast to Coast AM, my book shot up to number 9 out of 8.5 million on Amazon. I've signed books and mailed them to almost 20 different countries. People around the world want the truth. They want to hear the truth. And what we do need is a leader. I'm not quite sure if there is one here in this country or not. I know a lot of people come to me, but I'm just one retired flight attendant that has a lot of intuitive direction going to help me find the stuff. And I've been very blessed to get a lot of information. I would hope and pray that this country wakes up to the fact that the New World Order is a Zionist-controlled Nazi order, that we are all going to be Gazans if we don't get it stopped. And it's very serious. We're on the verge of another, I say it could possibly be nuclear 9/11. One of the things I discovered is that they also have a backdoor in the software that controls all of our weapons, nuclear, biological, chemical, and our major dams, like the Hoover Dam, our major nuclear reactors.
Well, it is indeed true that the companies that are contracted to the Pentagon that control their phones and computers are Israeli companies. I want to thank you so much. Before you both go, Russ, good luck in your election. I hope you win, and I can't wait to have you back on the show. The same with you, Rebecca. We must do this again. And where can people go to get your book?
You can get autographed books off of any one of my web pages, and I have three of them: Rebecca Roth, RebeccaRoth.com. methodicalillusion.com and methodicaldeception.com. And there's also an email button. You can contact me through email. And Russ, I would like you to contact me through that email button so I can get a book to you and get some information back and forth.
It would be great.
Thank you both very much. We're going to do this again, I promise you. We're going to take a brief break right now. And if both of you are near your radio or you're near your computer, you must listen to my next guest because he is absolutely brilliant. We'll be right back with Joe Satilli.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer, and this is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
I'd like to thank George Knack for that totally unsolicited review. If you go to Amazon and search That's the Last Word on the Assassination, you'll see scores and scores of unsolicited reviews. And while you're up there, if you're looking for a laugh or something to make you angry or to cheer you up or make you think even, it's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone, get my little book called John Barber's Facebook Page, Uncensored, Volume 1. And right now, I want to welcome one of my very favorite people in the world, There's no one in America who speaks and writes about the economy as clearly and as perceptively as my favorite and one and only repeat guest. He's an Emmy-winning journalist who co-hosts every Friday one of the liveliest topical internet shows in the country and publishes a daily news vandal, which I never miss, from the Bay Area, Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show, and I'm sorry if you're a few minutes late. They were just so interesting.
Well, John, if you love me so much, how do you have me following them? I mean, you used to have to open for Sinatra, which must have been a challenge, but just imagine having to follow Sinatra. Oy vey.
Well, as a matter of fact, at the end of my monologue on The Tonight Show, I said I would like to now thank Frank Sinatra for being my opening act, which indeed he was. But before we get to, do you have any thoughts on anything that they were talking about? Because you have thoughts and opinions about everything that are perceptive. Go ahead.
I lived in Washington, D.C. on 9/11. That morning I had to go in to Georgetown to do some work on a program that I was in the edit room on. And we got a phone call, went down the stairs. It was a gal that I had used to know here in the United States. She moved back to Australia. She said, you have to turn on the television. I turned on the television, saw the second plane go in, drove in to D.C. I had to get to work as I was going down Highway 50, taking the Cloverleaf to go through Arlington over the Key Bridge. I saw the smoke come off of the Pentagon. And then that evening, my great mentor in television and collaborator Ray Farkas, who has since passed, we got a call to go to New York the next day. We were on the next morning. We got on the train and went to Lower Manhattan and did a piece. And so I kind of experienced it viscerally. I can tell you, I examined the story assiduously for many, many years. And you know, John, I'm also an avid devotee, researcher, somebody who came to know you because of the Kennedy assassination and your incredible work, really seminal work, because Jim Garrison really is the guy who broke open the Kennedy assassination and established all of the facts. And I think one of the hardest things about 9/11 is to get to established facts. And after wandering through lots of certainty over the course of 5 or 6 years, I think I've come to a much more agnostic position. We have Building 7. Building 7 has never been explained. You have Ms. Roth was mentioning the war games that were going on that were being run by the National Security Agency. Some of the war games were of hijacked planes being crashed into buildings like the State Department in Washington, D.C. And she is absolutely right that when NORAD was contacting air in communication with air traffic controllers, they were saying, is this real world or is this game scenario?
Yes, I remember that.
Which accounts for the stand down. Also,
the saddest thing about 911 is that there is no Jim Garrison to bring somebody to trial. You know, when you posted on my Facebook page that you were going to be on, I got so excited because I read that you said something about the upbeat future of America. Now, this doesn't sound so upbeat, but then I go to your news vandal, which is just terrific. The first 6 or 7 stories about the economy, there doesn't seem to be anything upbeat about it. I mean, you're talking about the first story is 10 troubling numbers and then the staggering decline and fall. So would you like to elaborate on your first 4 or 5 stories in your news vandal?
Well, you set it up perfectly in your introduction that Labor Day should really be about the celebration of childbirth at this point. Now that union membership is negligible, we're talking 14 million people as opposed to, 56% of the population practically, I think it was about 56% in the middle of the 1950s in unions. Now, it's really interesting. That was during a Republican administration. That would have been Eisenhower. And the 50s is considered the heyday of the American middle class. It was actually the creation of the largest population of wealthy people, sort of the greatest distribution of wealth in the history of mankind was the post-World War II American middle class. What was one of the interesting facts about that? Well, they were mostly union workers. And what that meant was is that you had great benefits, you had great pay, you had great security, you had single earner households, right? Which meant that back then it was mother, but hey, you know, if we could go back to single earner households, why not have fathers be, you know, stay-at-home dads? But all of these things that created the middle class have slowly and methodically been dismantled. And I think
years ago when I was a critic at CNBC, one of the heartbreaking documentaries I saw, and you may have seen it too when you were younger, it was called Harlan County.
Oh, yeah, Harlan County, USA.
Yeah, and it was about coal mines in Kentucky. And now you have this wonderful article in your News Vandal about there are no more coal unions in Kentucky?
Yeah, last one is gone. It's over. So all of these blue-collar jobs, and this is the fascinating thing about where we are, is that, you know, one of the stories today was in the American Conservative, which is just about the most reliably interesting. You may not always agree with it, but it's the most reliably interesting political magazine in America today. And Patrick Buchanan, here's a Republican who has run for president, who still loves Richard Nixon, still defends Richard Nixon, writing about the death of unions in America, and noting that one of the reasons why unions have died is because you do not have economic patriotism in America. In other words, one of the driving one of the driving factors has been globalization. And one of the fascinating things about globalization and the outsourcing of jobs and the loss of manufacturing, yes, it started in the 70s. And you'll remember, John, it started with Made in Taiwan. And then in the 80s, it was Made in Japan. But it really wasn't until the trade deals, and it's not just NAFTA, there was a heady pace of deal making and the establishment of most favored nation status under Bill Clinton, most favored nation status for China, which finally catalyzed the ultimate end of the middle class in America, catalyzed the final dismantling of the manufacturing base and the growth of income inequality in America. I have a chart. I have a piece that's actually going to be coming out on Truth Out this week titled, I think they're going to go with How America Set Sail into a Sea of Red Ink. And one of the fascinating things about the arrival of consumer debt in America, because consumer debt is really the only way Americans can afford to be consumers now, because you can't do it simply by earning wages, because wages don't allow you to live the middle class lifestyle that all the advertising tells you you should be living. The income inequality in America, which we associate with the Reagan Revolution, actually, if you look at, I have an incredible chart, starting in 1995, 1996, that's when income inequality in America expanded almost exponentially. And the kind of income inequality where the people at the top are earning, CEOs are earning 200 or 300 times their workers really began in the Clinton administration. And it's inexorably linked to the trade deals and the offshoring of America's productive capability to other countries.
You know, when Christopher, my son, was about to graduate from high school, I actually was 13, a genius boy, and he asked me why he had to go to college, because I hadn't gone to college. I'd only gone to 1 year and then had to drop out, and I told him that he didn't have to. I mean, if he was an artist, if he was a musician, or if he was an athlete, at the time he was a golfer, he wouldn't have to go to college. Unless you needed the government seal of approval, so you had to be a doctor or a lawyer or accountant or something like that. Right now, kids who are going to college have to get into this enormous, enormous debt. And even if they graduate, they can't even now get a job. And you also have a wonderful story in your News Vandal about the problem for college kids.
Yeah, and this is a story that appeared on Vox, and there is this, it's a mantra that every parent chants to their kids. You have to go to college to get a good job and get ahead in the high-tech economy of the future. Remember the high-tech economy of the future? That's all they talked about under the Clinton administration, by the way, which is kind of interesting because Clinton, remember at one point said, I want to make a college education as common as a high school education. I'm going to say, yeah, it's going to be as bad as a high school education if you make it as common, because that's one of the things. It used to be that a high school education kind of prepared you for life, but now high school education is to prepare you. So now your kid, you got to go to college, and you have to go to college to prepare for a high tech world and to get those great jobs. Well, to get those great jobs, you have to go into a lot of debt. And this Vox story shows that, yes, you actually do make, if you earn a wage as a college graduate, you will make more than people who don't have a high school, don't have a college education. But the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of you are not getting jobs. So it actually doesn't really make much of a difference. It actually only goes to a small percentage of people, those jobs. And one of the fascinating things about this college industrial complex, as I call it, is that we have over 1.2, 1.3, the number fluctuates a little bit, $1 trillion in student debt. And about 87% of that is actually held by the federal government. They make a profit off of this debt every year, the federal government. It's the one way the federal government makes money. It's off of the backs of students trying to get a college education to get ahead, which they're not getting ahead because so many of them now live at home with their parents because they can't afford to even buy a home, let alone have a job and get an apartment and live sort of that wonderful, lifestyle you have in your 20s and 30s.
Do you remember a scientist named Buckminster Fuller?
Of course.
Yeah,
Buckyballs.
Yeah, he invented the geodesic dome. I interviewed him live in 1970 on the morning show, and he said something really profound. He said, people feel that their life is going to work, getting up in the morning, have a job, and going to work. He said, someday, that is going to be a luxury because there won't be any work, and if societies are designed properly, there wouldn't be any need to go to work. And now you have this really interesting thing on your news vandal again about the future of work, and so it reminded me of his conversation.
Well, I think this is the fascinating thing of where we're at economically, is that the consumer model has broken down mostly because it's been sustained by consumer debt beginning at the end of the 70s. It took off a little bit in the 80s, really took off in the 90s, where basically by the end of the – I think it was one in six families in 1976 had what we call a bank card, or we used to call a bank card. That would be a credit card. By the time Bill Clinton left office, the average card-holding family had six credit cards. So all of those credit cards were being used to make up the difference between middle-class aspirations and consumer desire. Well, since the 2008 crash, consumer desire has collapsed. It's one of the reasons why you see China having so many problems and is essentially in free fall in many ways. It's because, it used to be, well, China owns America. We got to be careful of China. And this is where Trump is really off base in his targeting of China. It's not so much that China owned America. It's that American corporations owned China's productive capabilities and squeezed out extra profits by using that cheap labor and sending those cheap plastic tchotchkes back to America to sell to consumers who were using credit cards to buy the stuff. And now that 2008 has happened and Americans can't consume, China is declining, and now you have this other problem coming, which is we're entering the age of migration. And we're entering the age of massive population growth and the age of robotics, where many jobs that were held by people at the bottom are being replaced by algorithms and are going to be replaced by algorithm-driven robots, which means where are people going to get work?
Speaking of low prices, I couldn't believe your article in your news vandal about Detroit selling some homes for $1,000. What kind of homes are they, and who would buy them, and who would live in them?
Well, there are a number of requirements in Wayne County. You can't have an outstanding a mortgage in another home that's already in arrears. There are all these different requirements inside Wayne County to buy one of these homes. You have to, if you're from outside Wayne County or whether in Michigan, you have to promise to live in the home for an X period of months. I think it's like a year and a half, maybe 18 months. But this is, in a sense, Detroit is the symbol of the end of the way of life that we call the American dream, which was based on good wages, good jobs, unionization, democracy. I mean, this is the other thing that goes along with this, right? As power has trickled, you know, we talk about trickle-down economics. I say it's a percolator up economy. That's really what it is, because what happens
is it's a vacuuming up economy.
Well, you know, over time, the reason we have these boom and bust cycles is that the system is designed to get the middle class and the working class to after they fall down, to generate wealth. You pop the bubble, all that wealth declines in value, so the assets become cheap, and the people at the top who retain either liquidity because they keep their money, or they have political influence that allows them to get loans, bailouts, to go buy up all those assets at a cut rate, they hoard all that wealth at the top. And it started with the savings and loan scandal, then it happened with the tech bubble, then it happened with the housing bubble, and now we're seeing it again with another stock market-driven bubble, where a lot of these stock prices are actually driven by buybacks, where corporations, to drive up the price of their stocks, are borrowing money and then going out into the stock market and buying their own stocks to artificially inflate the value of the stocks, and then the CEO gets a bonus because the value of the stock went up.
Let me ask you this question, and I heard it posed. You ever heard of a fellow named Webster Tarpley?
Yes, I have, yeah.
He seems to be exceptionally bright, very knowledgeable, speaks a couple of languages. But he has said on a number of radio shows, internet shows actually, that you could solve America's economic problem if you had a modest sales tax on stocks. In other words, millions of shares of stocks are exchanged every day on Wall Street. And he said, what if you had just a very nominal tax on that? Because it is buying and selling, so why not a sales tax? Do you think that's possible? And do you think it could happen?
Well, there are two things. One thing that's fascinating, I mentioned Pat Buchanan earlier talking about the death of unions tied to the end of economic patriotism. Isn't it interesting that Donald Trump, who is sounding some of those economic patriotism themes, also says we need to tax hedge fund managers? I think that's really, really interesting. And that's actually something that a lot of Americans want to hear, which is at least a lot of Americans want to hear now, or at least the people, the Tea Party folks who, you know, remember, the Tea Party started as an anti-banking bailout movement.
Yes, I remember
that. At its very beginning, it was leveraged and taken over and hijacked and turned into an Obama's birther blah 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 movement, which is too bad, because the economic populism movement that it began to be is something that America has kind of needed for a long, long time. But then, you know, these things get hijacked, I guess, kind of like planes. But anyway, you know, I did a piece for Truth Out on debt called the United States of indebtedness, about how all of Americans have gotten into this debt load. And one of the fascinating things, there was a poll that showed that people would like, over 70% wanted the government to do something about income inequality, over 70% wanted paid sick leave, they wanted pay family leave. There was all of these things that they wanted the government to do to end income and wealth inequality in America. The one thing that they would not support, less than 33% would support a tax on financial transactions. And that's exactly it, John.
Oh, is that my goodness gracious.
You have to tax these financial transactions, because people do not realize that the people who play monopoly with money have many, many ways of avoiding taxes. They don't have a payroll tax. They don't pay for the things that the average working person pays for in their weekly or biweekly paycheck. And it's that tax on financial transactions that Donald Trump is starting to hit at. And I think that that's really, really interesting. I mean, isn't it fascinating that you have Patrick J. Buchanan and Donald Trump advocating for things that you would expect the ostensible front runner of the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, should be advocating. But of course, Hillary Clinton, very much a friend of Wall Street.
Well, I must tell you, Joe, another 60 minutes has just flown by. You should have your own show, and you should have your own show every day. You're absolutely, absolutely wonderful. I want to thank you once again for being here, and you're going to be on again soon. And for those of you listening right now, if you thought the first half hour was interesting, wait until Wednesday, at 1 o'clock, from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock, we are going to have a woman on who has written what has been called by many scientists the most important book of the last 100 years, Where Did the Towers Go? She does not speculate one bit about who did it, but she explains very, very scientifically and mind-expandingly how the towers came down and were turned to dust. Dr. Judy Wood, we will talk to you Wednesday at 1 o'clock. All of you have a great weekend. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny.